coming to get you, Barbara.
I don't know what you come to do, but I come to praise name.
Because you'll never be anything but a common frump whose father lived over a grocery store and whose mother took in washing.
Hey, y'all. Welcome to Huchaya. It's your boy. I'm your host, Ricky Carmona. Joining me in the studio tonight, oh, the one and only. She hosts Switchblade Sisters podcast. I look to her for dope shit. Sometimes it snows in April. April Wolf. Woo. 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 Come on now.
My friends call me Sleepy Wolf. I'm so tired all the time.
I was driving in, as I usually do.
Yeah.
When we come record, and I was just thinking of you yawning. On previous and I was like, I hope April doesn't yawn tonight.
You talked about it. I do it.
51 seconds
I made it 51 seconds before I started yawning. The time change fucks me up so much that I don't think I can even express how much I hate the time change.
Well, you've been around the world, and the time and daylight saving.
I got
daylight
a lot saving of excuses.
Time. Yes. So come on with all of them. Well, what is good with you, April?
Well, this is dumb, but...
It's not dumb. This is a safe space.
I was, looking at trips to Vegas just because I was like, oh, maybe I'm going to go to Vegas. And my sister, who goes to Vegas with her wife, once a fucking month, and they live in Michigan, she has, these cheats to get better deals. And
yes.
So she told me to sign up for a website called smartervegas.com. And that shit unlocks some deals. And she is so smart, and I'm so grateful, but I'm just like, what? You can get a hotel room at the Paris for $50 and a $100 credit for the buffet?
Yes.
That's insane. So you also get cheaper show tickets and things.
Yes.
So I was just like, do I want to live my best gaudy life? I might.
I wish you would.
I think I will.
Wish you would.
That's it. That's me.
Okay. My man, el mero mero de Navidad, he likes to party. He don't... He just loves Christmas parties. Film reviews editor at The Rep, Alonzo Duralde. Alonzo, how are you, sir?
I'm good.
What? Oh, are you? Because I was about to ask you, what is good with you, sir?
Well, not me, but
all
I mean...
All right. Okay, cancel
what's,
that.
What's good is that Oprah has released her annual favorite things list.
Okay.
Which is always awesome and hilarious at the same time. It's like this sort of wonderful indulgence of... You know, pampering products and cool tech things and neat little crafty items, but also, you know, $360 makeup brushes.
Yes. What are they made of?
I want
are
to
Are they
know.
Made out of unicorn Oprah's hair. Eyelashes?
Yes. Oprah's eyelashes and unicorn hair. Yeah.
Sorry, it's a 10-piece set,
oh,
but still,
okay.
$360.
I'm trying to break that down.
That's $36 a brush. You can also spend that $36 on bubble bath. That's also on the list.
Okay.
So it's like, yeah, it's a fun fantasy, and it's also, Oprah, you're insane. You haven't paid retail for anything in a very long time, and when you do, you have no idea what anything costs.
Yes, I'll buy 1,000 of them.
Exactly.
When you drive into the studio, what do you imagine Alonzo doing?
When I'm driving,
he doesn't think about me.
No, I don't, actually.
Aww.
I think of what Alonzo will be disappointed in whatever my staff pick is.
That's sweet.
Yes. That is so not. That is not fair.
It's not fair, but I hold you in such high esteem. I shit you not. Real talk. When I don't know what episode it was recently, but I was like, my staff pick is contact, and I looked over at Alonzo, and he was like, ugh. If you go back and listen to that episode, I was like, I love Contact. And then there's a pause. It's because I look over at Alonzo, and he gives me this, whether you were doing it intentionally or not.
My face just does that.
Yes. This look of disgust where I was like, I like Jodie Foster. And then I just, like, moved on to, like, shout out to, like, our 5-star reviews.
Oh, yeah. poor little Ricky.
I'm so sorry.
No, don't be sorry, bro. No. I respect both of y'all's opinions, and I come in here with like, oh, I got this one tonight. And when I don't have it, I'm like, oh, I need to do more work.
Oh, yeah, I've got that school mom thing. Hey, Ricky, what's up?
Nicely done. Yeah.
What's good with you?
Yes. Yo, shout out to my hip-hop heads, which I feel like are 12 of them who listen to this podcast. But this past weekend, February 9th, 1993, marks the 25-year anniversary of not only Tribe Called Quest's Midnight Marauders coming out on that date, but also Wu-Tang Clan's Enter the 36 Chambers came out on that date.
Drea right now is in her car going, what?
Shout out to Drea, the dope rhyme sayer. Lord to the underground, the chief rocker. That day, like, those two albums coming out on the same day, that is the equivalent of if the Two Towers and Terminator 2 Judgment Day came out on the same day. Like, psh, brain exploding. Now I know what that sets the course for what the next 4 or 5 years of what my life are going to be. And that's what those two albums did. That's what just happened this weekend. And there is a great album that has been released on SoundCloud by a DJ who I'm not familiar with, but this DJ put together this mashup album. This DJ, his name is Filthy Rich, DJ Filthy Rich.
Is there like a dollar sign in anywhere in his name?
I hope so.
Oh, God.
I hope so much. I hope so.
No
so
S's,
much.
But what the hell?
But maybe like in between, like, yes. Filthy dollar sign Rich. Yes. I like that.
Yes. But he put out this album that is called Enter the Midnight Marauders. I believe that's what it's called. And what he did is he took all the vocals from Enter the 36 Chambers and he laid them over all the beats from Midnight Marauders. You can find this album on SoundCloud and just listen to that shit. And if you're a fucking 42-year-old hip-hop head like me, you're like, ooh, I remember sophomore year in high school. This shit is so hot. Hey, y'all, on this week's episode, what a transition, Ricky. Thank you. On this week's episode, we're going to be talking about the not Christmas movie, Overlord, which is in theaters right now. We're going to be paying a tribute to Stan Lee, R.I.P. And we're also going to be, Alonzo, that full Christmas minute, son.
60 seconds. Do not cheat me.
We will not be cheating you, son. And we'll be giving our staff picks as well. But before we get into all of that, hey, it is time for It a Dick. Short for Is This Important? Do I Care? How it works is, you've listened to this show. You know how it works. We're going to read news stories. Everybody is going to respond with their hot takes as far as, is this important? Do I care? And I am excited about this first news story because I am somebody who hates on musicals. I know I've said that before. Mm-hmm. I have given sermons on this show about how I hate musicals. But my man, Spike Lee. Spike is doing the rounds right now, promoting Black Klansman, which is going to be released on Blu-ray and on digital. And he was on Cinema Blend talking to Eric Eisenberg. And Spike said, oh yeah, I'm going to direct a musical one day, for sure. I mean, there are many musical elements in my films already, but this one I want to do straight out singing and dancing, beginning to end, high-stepping, wailing musical. Is this important? Do I care? I hate musicals. I care, goddammit.
I gotta understand the reason why you wanna try and make things right. I don't wanna be alone tonight. Oh, pretty baby, I don't want another useless night. I don't wanna be alone tonight.
You guys are missing the arms that he does with this.
You gotta do the arms.
A production, yo.
I think Spike Lee could do a really good musical, and I think that there are not enough musicals with black people, for instance. Mm. And I think that also limits the kinds of music that people use in musicals, because then, you know, that's honestly like one of my things against some of the new musicals that comes out. I'm just like, oh, this is so white bread that it is just like kind of pop, passionless pop in a way that I just don't get connecting to it. But it would be lovely to see musicals that have more soul and more emotional connection.
Yeah.
I love School Days. I mean, I think it's already a terrific musical, but yes, do another one. Do more of them. And yes, more musicals with black people, more musicals with black inflected music, all that stuff. Like, remember, what was the Outkast movie? Idlewild,
yes, son.
Oh, shit.
Yes.
Remember,
how
the closing credits of that movie were this amazing musical number, and you're like, where was this for the whole rest of the movie? You know, yeah, I would love more of that. Totally.
Yeah, yeah. I have shit on musicals, and April, you saying that, I feel like when I shit on musicals and when I say, like, that's not for me, it's because they just stick to, like, such a formulaic kind of like, here's how musicals have been done, and we're going to give you another version of that. Does Spike Lee making a musical get me excited about musicals happening? No. Mm-hmm. But a new version of a musical from Spike Lee, does that get me excited? Hell yes. Absolutely. I'm all for that.
All right. On Tuesday, cable channel FX asked the Supreme Court not to hear Olivia de Havilland's Feud case, which was rejected by the California High Court in July. Two-time Oscar winner de Havilland had filed a lawsuit in 2007 alleging Catherine Zeta-Jones' portrayal of her in the FX miniseries Feud damaged her professional reputation for integrity, honesty, generosity, self-sacrifice, and dignity. De Havilland said FX never asked her for her permission nor spoke with her about the role. The lawsuit was dismissed. The appellate court reasoned that Zeta-Jones' portrayal of Olivia didn't qualify as highly offensive, and because Feud was a work of fact and fiction, the creators couldn't be found to have acted in malice. Do you want me to read all of this? The legalese that FX filed with SCOTUS, they said, contrary to petitioner's hyperbole, the Court of Appeal did not hold the First Amendment grants absolute immunity to docudramas, nor anything close to that. The court actually held, far more modestly, that petitioner's false-like claim failed as a matter of law because, one, she could not show the snippets of dialogue.
It's too much.
This is your Christmas minute, bro. This is your Christmas minute.
There you go.
Is this important? Do you care? I just want to say, I know we're skipping over this and y'all can read an article to get the whole full skinny on this whole thing, but I think this case actually is important in the same way that cases that defended, like, Mad Magazine's right to parody movies, or, you know, Gary Trudeau's right, or even Larry Flint's right to make fun of public figures. There is a right to satire, certainly, and while Feud may not fall in that category, I think that if Olivia de Havilland is allowed to sue because she doesn't like the way that this show portrayed her, that gets us into a very weird area where no biopic is going to meet the standard of, you know, making sure that every living person is going to sign off on it.
Yeah.
It's like, no. I love how bitchy she is in suing, but I'm like, oh, just, you can't win because it's kind of going to ruin a lot of things.
Part of my problems with biopics lately has been, I mean, we just talked about Bohemian Rhapsody, is that the person who is directly involved is just too much involved with it and says, like, no. It needs to be this version of the story.
Right.
And it's like, no, I kind of, it should be kind of like open to interpretation. So, I mean, I feel you, Olivia, but
yeah, like,
I also want,
if it were about this one specific thing, you'd be like, well, I see you have a point. But yeah, the ramifications of this are scary.
The precedent it sets is,
exactly.
it sets is like, ugh, not something I want to support.
No.
I am working on the April Wolf story, and the April Wolf story will present you as so fair and
Really? I'm not.
In my version, you hate Suspiria, just like I did.
That's something where
you
might
co-sign off on that, right?
I might draw the line at that one. Pretty much anything else you can say about me, and I'll be like, well, I'm Catholic. I think the worst of myself anyway. So.
All right, one more story here. And this is actually kind of like a serious story here. Here in California, there have been just god-awful wildfires that have been happening in the northern and southern parts of California. Here's one story that's not as awful that has been coming from there. Actor James Woods has been using his celebrity for good. Oh, has he? The conservative known for tweeting inflammatory opinions, he's been using his Twitter account to help victims of the fire by signal boosting their messages. He's been retweeting those in need of assistance who uses hashtags, hashtag campfire James Woods, or hashtag SoCalFire James Woods. One person who has benefited from Woods' assistance is actress Alyssa Milano, who tweeted, "If anyone can get five horses out of here, please help me." James Woods retweeted Milano. Someone tweeted at him, "Why would anyone want to help at Alyssa Milano?" To which James Woods responded, "Because her animals are in danger and she needs help. Is this important? Do you care?"
Yes.
Yes.
This is so weird because yeah. James Woods is a dick,
yes.
Generally speaking, and behaves so boorishly online. But
terribly online.
It is nice to know that in times of genuine crisis that people can put that stuff aside and, you know, yeah, I mean, Alyssa Milano, you know, she was sitting behind Kavanaugh at those hearings, you know, like she's very much on one end and he's very much on another. But it's like, you know what? There's a fire and these horses are in danger and let's deal with that.
Yeah.
And so I guess it gives me hope.
One of the things that I've always found fascinating, and I actually wrote a short story about this, is that when it comes to natural disasters and terrible things happening, news reports tend to put pictures of animals front and center, not even necessarily people, but pictures of animals. And you look at Alyssa Milano trying to get her like help for her horses. The one uniting thing that people can all come together with is that we don't want these fucking animals to die, and that seeing them like sad and hurt is something that none of us want. And so it actually is the one thing that kind of generates this empathy, which you don't often do that. Like, you don't always do that for humans, but something about an animal.
Well, yeah, they didn't choose
you
to live in Malibu.
No, exactly. I mean, I'm sure they enjoyed it for a time, but they didn't choose that shit.
Yeah. All politics aside, if you are in support of helping trapped horses, any kind of pets or animals that just don't have a way to get out, then yeah, we definitely all need to like support each other and get those animals out. So I strangely care about what
I know.
Let's get each other out of the fire.
Words out is so hard.
I care
now
about James Woods. Yeah.
Look, get each other out of the fire, and then we can fight more later.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That's absolutely right. Let's save the animals. Save those in need, and we'll have our fucking political conversations. Hopefully never beyond that.
No, look, let's never stop saying that James Woods is awful.
He's a piece of shit. Okay, you know, all right, okay, you're right.
Let's,
you're right.
Let's
you're right.
Table that, deal with the fire, and then we can come back to it.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. We're going to take a break right now, and when we come back, we will be talking about Overlord, y'all. You are listening to Who Shot Ya?
Since the dawn of time, screenwriters have taken months to craft their stories. But now, three Hollywood professionals shall attempt the impossible. Break a story in 1 hour.
That's right. Here on Storybreak, I, Freddie Wong,
Matt Arnold,
and Will Campos, the creators behind award-winning shows like Video Game High School,
have 1 hour to turn a humble idea into an awesome movie.
Now, an awesome movie starts with an awesome title.
I chose The Billionaire's Marriage Valley.
Mine was Christmas Pregnant Paradise.
Okay, next we need a protagonist.
So I've heard Wario best described as libertarian Mario.
And of course, every great movie needs a stellar pitch. In order to
get to heaven, sometimes you gotta raise a little hell.
That's the tagline!
Check out Storybreak every week on MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, welcome back to Hushaya. I'm your host, Ricky Carmona. Join me in the studio today are...
April Wolf.
Alonzo Duraldi.
Today we are talking about Overlord. April, fan of the, can I say, niche genre?
Yeah, genre shit.
Genre
shit.
Yes!
La mer du genre.
Yes! I'm excited that we're talking about this movie because I'm excited to hear your opinions on it. So, just to start off, can you please give us a brief synopsis of said film?
Sure.
Genre film, which a goddamn yawning is!
So every time I look at Ricky, I start yawning. And
come on!
I'm not trying. I don't know if it's like the air pressure
I'm
or what.
Okay. Wearing all the colors possible.
I know. I'm so sorry.
You're so soothing, Ricky.
Okay, so like, let's get into Overlord. So Okay. You got a platoon of American soldiers who are going to be parachuting out into very dangerous Nazi territory. They have one mission, which is to take out a antenna, a
radio tower.
Yes.
That is on top of a church, and that is going to allow the Allied forces to actually finally come in and you know, take over the area of France that they're in. So they go down, and most of them perish. And then the few that are left have to travel to try to find a way to, you know, go up against hundreds of Nazis with just a very few resources. One of them goes into a building and into the church in the basement and finds something that is very shocking. And then they, you know, they have to try to figure out how to infiltrate it, beat some super Nazis. I don't want to give things away. Beat some super Nazis and then... take down the tower still while people are, you know, like they may or may not survive.
Do people not know what this movie's about?
They were pretty like it, like they didn't give that much away in the trailers, if I remember.
Okay.
I can't remember, or at least the early trailers, but I can't remember what the
I was going to say one of the things with this movie was when I was watching it is what a different experience it would have been if they didn't give so much away in the trailer.
Ah, okay.
Because I feel in the trailer, they tell you pretty much everything. Yeah, it's just like you said, these soldiers are coming in. They need to take this tower down. And then if the trailer would have stopped right there and I just knew I was coming into like some war movie where there was a mission, I would be all in. And I was still kind of... For the most part, I was like kind of in, but the one flaw is the trailer just tells you, hey, just so you know, and then Nazi zombies are going to show up.
I didn't see the trailer, but all the everything I heard about this at a Fantastic Fest was Nazi zombies, the Nazi zombie movie. So
and I feel like it would have been such a different experience if you didn't know that was happening, because the movie, after that trailer is released, the movie still presents it as like, there's a mystery that is coming. There's no mystery coming. And you just show me where the Nazi zombies are. And when you do show me that, I'm not surprised.
Mm.
You've already told me that your whole marketing is based on this.
Well, the marketing didn't work, clearly, because the movie had a shitty opening weekend, which is sad because I thought it was really good. And I'm not a horror guy, so, like, you know, my as a friend of mine once actually told me, it's like, you know, we were discussing how much, like, my not liking horror sort of affects what he thinks about my opinions. He goes, if you like a horror movie, it means very little to me. Like, okay, then. But he also liked this movie. I know. Because it starts as a very kind of like post Saving Private Ryan Dunkirk kind of war movie with lots of close-ups and very intense action and, you know, this sort of like nightmarish sense of like, I'm in this very flimsy airplane and it is being shot at and like people are dying all around us. And so, you know, it operates at that level, and then you get to the zombies, and you're like, whoa, you know, which is just kind of adding to it. But what's great is that once the zombies arrive, they still got to take that tower down. Like, that never goes away. That doesn't get pushed aside because, oh no, zombies. They've still got this ticking clock. They've got to get that tower down by 6 a.m. so that, like, Eisenhower can storm the beaches at Normandy. Yeah, I think it works.
Yeah. April,
I feel
you
like the ticking clock element wasn't there enough. Like,
really?
And I think, I don't know, the screenwriting seemed a little bit shoddy to me. I did overall enjoy it, but the screenwriting seemed shoddy to me. If you have a character who has to say, "Can somebody tell me what the hell is going on?" That generally means, like, I don't understand context clues and I am too dumb to pay attention. You know, like, if you have that character who's saying that, I think, you know, you need to do a rewrite.
Yeah.
And that kind of laziness kind of soaked into most of the dialogue, and because of that, I didn't feel an urgency. You know, like there's not a lot of, like, there's a moment where Wyatt Russell's character Ford takes like a detour and is just like, well, no, I'm gonna take some time to beat the shit out of this guy. When before, for, you know, he was like, no, we have like 0600, we need to have it done by then, and then but all of a sudden he's just leisurely beating the shit out of some guy. Like, it things just didn't character wise and time wise, they didn't quite add up. So I felt like it really easily could have been tighter. Like, it's not, it wouldn't even be like a difficult fix, it's just like laziness.
Yeah,
I don't know.
I agree with you. I actually enjoyed the beginning of the movie, where it just really throws you into, like you said, Alonzo, this Saving Private Ryan kind of environment of, like, shit is just going fucking bananas. I actually thought I was thinking very much of a Edge of Tomorrow, where, yeah, like the Edge of Tomorrow has a little bit more of like a story set up to it than this movie does. Edge of Tomorrow just kind of like gives you more like a little character background. This movie just throws you into the plane that is like flying over the beach. Is it a beach in Normandy, or
well,
visually
Normandy's
do you just get
a beach,
that
but they're going to a village.
They're going
behind enemy lines to like take out this radio tower, which is probably nowhere near the coast, but it's still going to be essential as far as communicating with soldiers who are at the coast.
Yes, and just visually, I just felt like, oh man, we are like in the fucking shit right now. And then we're dropped down into this territory, and then it turns kind of like into like this B movie, but it doesn't. It just doesn't kind of. It tries to do too many things, I think, and I would have preferred that it is a war movie that is slowly revealed to be like this weird Nazi zombie.
Yeah,
kind
well, you
of
wouldn't know
film.
That because you also saw the trailer first,
and I feel yeah, like
which I when I think about I don't it, know I actually don't think that I did see the trailer, and maybe that's why it was more surprising to me.
Well,
yeah.
I think this is also a problem that people don't know how to sell a movie that crosses genres.
Oh yeah,
yes.
You know,
that's
had this
been
just been a war picture, or had this just been a horror movie, they'd know how to sell that. But as both, they're clearly baffled about it. And I think it's also tough to, in the internet age, to sell a secret because everyone's dying to give it away.
Yeah. Is that a J.J. Abrams?
He produced it.
Yeah,
yeah, no, I was going to say, is that a J.J. Abrams problem? Is this something that was out of his hands?
Oh, the actual marketing? I would be surprised. I mean, it's a Paramount movie, and, like, you know, he makes the Mission Impossible movies there, so I can't imagine him not getting his way.
Yeah.
And like the one sheets were kind of vague about what this was. Like, there was one where it was like a blood spatter pattern, but they made it look like falling parachutes, you know? Mm-hmm. And I could see where people would look at the poster and be like, what is this? You know, but I guess I didn't see the trailer. So that might have been more explicit. What's interesting also is, you know who wrote this movie?
I don't know. I looked up the names, but I was familiar with them.
Billy Ray, who wrote like Captain Phillips and Shattered Glass.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And Mark L. Smith, who wrote The Revenant.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So, like, two Oscar bait champs here.
Really?
You know, getting down and dirty with a genre pick.
Which, and I remember that was one of the reasons why I was just like, wow, this dialogue is terrible.
Yeah.
And I was like, was there dialogue in The Revenant? Maybe not.
Not much.
Yeah. So I get it.
Wow. Would this movie have been better suited as a Netflix release?
No, I don't know why people didn't go to see it, honestly. I mean, I'm with Alonzo that, like, this is a great movie to see on the big screen because it's, like, terrifying when it's supposed to be terrifying. And the special effects are fucking on point.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you can tell that they're pretty minimal with the CGI when it came to the blood and the guts. And that was pretty intense.
Yeah.
You know?
This is a pretty splattery, like, R-rated horror movie.
Yeah.
It reminded me very much of, I don't know if it's because Wyatt Russell is in it and he's Kurt Russell's son, but I felt like there was very much like a John Carpenter, The Thing kind of like visual feel to it.
Can we talk about Wyatt a little bit
please
more?
Please do, yeah. Speak
I'm
on
in
it.
Love
speak
with
on
it.
Oh, honey, he's get like, in line.
Oh my God. But I've got two petitions.
Okay.
One is for him to get some accent coaching to get rid of his SoCal bro accent. And then
he says sut dude a lot in this movie.
Right? And then the second one is just for him to take all of Chris Pratt's roles.
Oh, I like that very much.
Have you watched any of Lodge 49?
No, but it keeps coming up with, like, it's just like on my Sling TV. It's just like, are you sure you don't want to watch Lodge 49? I'm like, I don't have time. Jesus, it's award season.
What's Lodge 49? So people know and myself.
It's Wyatt Russell's show on AMC.
And what's it about?
It's about, he plays this guy who is sort of kind of dealing with the death of his father and, you know, kind of at loose ends. And then he sort of winds up joining this strange lodge, you know, like an old sort of like Elks Lodge or whatever, and kind of falls in with these older dudes there. And I've only watched the pilot, so I don't really know where it goes, but people really love the show, and I like what I've seen so far. Again, I don't have time either, but I like what I've seen so far, and I like him a lot. I thought he was really good, and everybody wants some. I think he's super appealing.
He joins a secret lodge
in this
movie.
No.
The TV show.
In his TV show. Yeah. Isn't he's the lead. He's the lead.
It's a hiccup.
He's the lead in The Invitation, no?
No.
No.
That's Logan Marshall Green.
God damn it.
Logan Marshall Green is the guy that everybody confuses with Tom Hardy.
Yeah, those two actually look alike. But
wow.
Wyatt Russell just looks like his dad.
Yeah. with a little bit of Goldie thrown.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. It's like a perfect match between the two.
That's what I was like there's shots in this movie where I was just like,
oh, at certain
so
angles
glad.
He's full on Kurt
Russell.
Yeah.
I'm so glad y'all made babies together. It's
so great. It's just so sweet. I love it. And in my head there was a Death Becomes Her nod because he does impale someone with a large.
Oh, yeah, that's funny.
Yeah, and they can't die. I don't know.
I think actually, now that you mentioned it, I was thinking about Death Becomes Her 1.2
because
of people not dying and stuff.
Is that
right?
I got a commando nod from that. The John is the Matrix when it goes to him. But the legit Kurt Russell nod that I got was. It's a scene that does not involve Wyatt Russell. It's an old girl who's. I feel like there was
Flamethrower.
A lot. What's her name?
Flamethrower, the Chloe.
Yes, you know what I'm gonna say. Yeah. God damn it, April, you're my girl.
I mean, let's not give it away, but there's definitely a.
No, there are. I feel like there's John Carpenter seeds in this movie where it's like, hey, if you grew up liking this movie or you are aware of this movie, and we have the son of one of the stars of that movie, then yes, you are going to be able to make the connection.
Yeah, just better dialogue would have been helpful.
Yeah.
The lead actor, Jovan, what is it? Jovan?
Adepo. He was the son in Fences.
He's the son in Fences.
Him with Wyatt Russell together, those are the scenes that I liked the best. I liked those two actors together. And that kid obviously has a very bright future ahead of him. His role in Fences was like...
Yes, yeah. I actually felt like the acting performances were fine, but it was more like you said, April, like give them all better dialogue. Give them a better script.
God, it's weird how movies can be better with dialogue.
With the words they say.
Some good words.
It's weird. With talky words.
Yes.
I mean, I didn't hate it, but I mean, as far as like, you know, there were no lines where I just went, ugh. But I think also in a genre movie, I tend to be more like, well, this is going to be a certain level of dopey. And so I'm not as tough on it, but you know, I don't dwell in this house as much as you do. So
I have been living in this house. It's more like an apartment.
She got an Airbnb on this bitch. She like, oh, motherfucker, stay in it. So what do we think, y'all? Should people screen it, stream it, or skip it? Alonzo, what would you say?
I would say screen it, actually, because I had a really good time. I think that who wrote the stupid hot take about how 2018 was a bad year for horror? Was it Vogue?
It was Vogue.
Yeah, shut up, Vogue. that was such clickbait, because there's been a lot of really interesting horror films this year, I think, and probably and April's seen way more of them than I have. But no, I thought it was entertaining, and because of the intensity, especially those early scenes where they're under fire in the plane and stuff, you want that. That's a theater experience.
Yeah. I'm with Alonzo. I would say I'd screen it, despite my issues with it. I still think it can be a fun time, and you know, you want to have some escapist, you know, punch a Nazi fun, then yeah. Go for it.
Yeah.
Burn it with fire.
Yeah, I would say, I don't know how long this movie is going to be in the theaters, but if you have a chance to catch it in the theaters and screen it, I would definitely say screen it.
If it's still there when this episode drops.
Yeah. Outside of that, I would say get a chance to stream it. Find a way to see this movie, because it's like a fun little, yeah. It's a fun little like B horror movie that like mixes genres and the cast is solid. I had much more fun than I was expecting to have with this. It was a pretty good time at the movie theater. Were you gonna say something, April?
No.
Oh.
Don't you take us to break at this point?
All right, I think we should take a break, y'all. We're gonna take a break. When we come back, we will be talking about Excelsior. Mr. Stanley, R.I.P. You are listening to Who Shot Ya.
How does this sound? A weekend on a beautiful mountaintop in California. You wake up, eat a tasty meal with some new friends, some old friends, maybe the hosts of your favorite podcasts. After that, it's a couple of inspiring classes, spectacular podcast tapings, a hilarious stand-up showcase, a dance party, and more. And s'mores! All of this can be yours at Max FunCon, returning to Lake Arrowhead next June. Tickets go on sale Friday, November 23rd. Put that on your calendar, because Max FunCon tickets always sell out. Get a head start planning your next summer vacation and go to maxfuncon.com to learn more.
Welcome back to Who Shot Ya? I'm your host, Ricky Carmona. Joining me in the studio today are
April Wolf,
Alonzo Duraldi,
Stan Lee, y'all. Cultural juggernaut behind Marvel Comics, co-creator of some of the most popular comic book characters in the world, died last weekend at 95 years old. Gone too soon.
Well, he had a good run.
He gave us the Fantastic Four, along with Jack Kirby. Also gave us X-Men, Iron Man, Hulk, Thor, Spider-Man.
With Steve Ditko.
With Steve Ditko, thank you. I mean, just these are all iconic comic book characters. Some of them have gone on to become iconic movie characters. So today we just wanted to share some of our favorite memories.
Yeah, I wrote a piece for The Wrap about this.
Okay.
Because, you know, I read comics as a kid. I had my oldest sister, is like 13 years older than me, goofed off a lot in college and read a lot of comic books. And so I started picking them up from her. And one of the books she read was Fantastic Four. And Stan Lee was very savvy about imprinting himself as a personality into the books. You know, like the title page of every Marvel comic book back in the day would have like a little Stan Lee Presents signature in the upper left hand corner. There was always a letter from him, like Stan's soapbox in every issue. You know, I remember at the, as a kid getting like Origin of Marvel Comics and Son of Origins, like these books that they put out, and he would write all the intro material for each of the different heroes talking about their secret origin, and he would kind of give the backstory of how it came about, and you know, he would put himself in the middle of every story, you know. Like comics historians have since had to be, have spent a long time kind of undoing his myth making, be like, well, actually he came in late on this one or this other idea, and then he kind of tweaked it a little or whatever.
Yeah.
But as a as a huckster and as a sort of show business figure, he was really unparalleled in comics. He was somebody like William Castle or, you know, Walt Disney in terms of like making himself as much of a brand as the product was. But, you know, the Marvel in the 60s was very influential. It was the first time we got superheroes who were neurotic and had money problems and had emotional issues and weren't just like, you know, strong.
Rah, rah, rah.
Yeah, daring yes. Jew, do square jaw guys with their underwear on the outside.
Yes.
You know? And so he did really make a big difference in the culture. And then obviously now in the last 10 or 15 years, we've seen how much like that has become like the center of popular culture as far as movies and TV are concerned, for better or worse. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I mean, he's a key figure.
Yeah, it's very – what I found was very strange of we are now giving Stan Lee all of the well-deserved props and respect, which just happens to coincide – with how tired we are of comic book movies. But I feel like he overshadows that. I feel like he really, I mean, it's without him.
He was comics when comics weren't cool.
Yes, very, very much so. Very much so. April, what's your relation to Stan Lee?
Well, I didn't read comics when I was a kid. I didn't, you know, we didn't have any kind of books or anything in my house.
Reading was not allowed in your house.
Reading was reading was something you had to go and pursue on your own time somewhere outside of the house. So, I mean, that was all quite new to me. So it's only been really since they started making these comic book movies that I've been actually introduced to kind of the deeper stories that have, you know, been with these characters for a very long time. So I do think that I tend to like the Stan Lee comics more than I like any other comic book movies. Like, it's a pretty clear cut of what I'm interested in, and it's usually his stuff where, you know, they all have like these social justice storylines in them, you know, baked into the identity of it, and I just really appreciate that. And, you know, I appreciated that Sam Raimi got to make a fucking Spider-Man movie.
Yeah.
How many? Two, three?
He made three of them. Yeah. Yeah.
Jesus,
yeah.
You know, and I love him.
I would say Darkman, which is a Sam Raimi non-comic book movie, mm-hmm. but also yeah. kind of like his
clearly
way of being
inspired
like,
by,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I've always seen comic books as like soap operas for men.
Totally.
And I mean mm-hmm. that in a good way, because uh-huh. I obviously am a big fan of soap operas, and you have these serializations that, like, the character has so many rebirths and regenerations.
Sure.
And
April's a huge fan of Betty LaFayette.
That's a joke for my mom.
Don't even call me General Hospital's mom. I got to watch my stories.
But, you know, like, that's...
No, I agree.
Yeah.
Part of it, and, you know, it's weird to see comics get this kind of gravitas, and soap operas are still not.
It's funny. Back when Superman Returns came out, I was still at The Advocate, and I did a piece about why gay men respond to comics, and part of it was the soap aspect. And a friend of mine, Mark Salzberg, gave me a quote along the lines of, like, a really good run of X-Men is like a season of Falcon Crest.
Yeah, that's the thing. I used to watch the X-Men cartoon when I, like, would come home from school, and, like, the X-Men cartoon was just like, thank you for my soaps, you know, yeah. because I would miss like the actual daytime TV while I was at school, but then I would come home and it'd be like, this is great. It's just like they have superpowers, but it's the same fucking thing.
Scott and Gene love each other, but they can't say it to each other.
Exactly. Yeah, it's like it's all the same shit.
Yeah, I'm not gonna lie. I've been more of a comic book movie fan than I have been a comic book fan. I grew up with, I mean, the first comic book movie I remember was Richard Donner Superman, which is DC, but I mean, I just remember that was huge.
Yeah.
And then then we just got like a string of Superman sequels that got, outside of Superman 2, which I stand by, the Richard Donner cut. They just started to fall apart, and then they all just kind of became parodies of each other and just kind of like real silly. But then when you had your X-Men's come along in the late 90s, your Sam Raimi Spider-Man's, and people just started to be like, okay, yeah, there's like stories here that can be told. People just paid more attention to Stan Lee and started to give him more props as well, and just let audiences know and like, hey, these aren't just comic book movies. It's not just somebody who puts on a suit. They also represented the outsiders of society at the time.
Yeah.
Who this is how they could kind of like take the power back. As far as being outcasts.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, Bryan Singer, when he would talk about the early
I didn't want to say his name.
I know. But look, X2 was still good.
X2 is very good.
But when we talk about those early X-Men movies, and he would bring up the notion of, like, you know, Professor X and Magneto representing the Martin Luther King, Malcolm X dichotomy, or the sort of like, you know, the different modes of, you know, whether it's queer liberation or any kind of liberation politics, you know, the working within the system versus the violent overthrow. Like, that wasn't a stretch, and that was always there in the comics too, you know, and so you go back to the old original 60s X-Men comics, and yeah, they are having those discussions about, like, you know, how do they want to assimilate into society? Do they want to destroy society? You know,
yeah.
Do they want to take it over? Do they want to, you know, help build it to be something better? So those ideas were always there. And so for a 12-cent book that was aimed at 10-year-olds, like, Stan Lee may not have been like a great poet, but he had ideas, and he and his writers put that into the work.
Yeah, it's okay if you all don't have an answer to this, but do you have a Marvel comic book movie that you would recommend to people that is kind of like, here's an idea, here's a good representation of what Stan Lee was trying to do in films? Whether it's X-Men 2, like you just said?
X-2 or, you know, Spider-Man Homecoming.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's a less angsty Peter Parker, but I think it is a very... It is that thing of like, I'm a regular normal person that this crazy ass thing has happened to. How do I incorporate that into my otherwise normal life?
Yeah. April, do you have one?
Hell, Black Panther.
There you go.
Whoa. Whoa. That is so far not what I thought you were going to say.
Why? What did you think I was going to say?
I had no idea what you were going to say, but I didn't think you were going to double down.
Keeping you on your toes.
Yeah, I like it. That's what's up, yo. That's what's up. Black Panther for sure. I would, you know, I would, and you knocked my thoughts out of place right there. I would say Black Panther. I would go with the Bryan Singer. X-Men 2, and I would say definitely, I would say Spider-Man 2. I think sometimes we kind of shit on the Sam Raimi Spider-Mans now looking back, but I would say Spider-Man 2 is solid.
Oh, they're fun.
Yeah.
They're super fun.
I think
Spider-Man 2 is great.
People shit on Spider-Man 3, and they shit on the Mark Webb ones, but I think Raimi's 1 and 2 people are pretty kind to.
Yes, Spider-Man 2 is solid. And I enjoy X-Men 2.
And I live in hope that someone's going to do a decent Howard the Duck movie, because that was a brilliant comic book. I swear to God, it was. It really was.
Is it?
Okay. Yes.
Okay. I'm that's where I am of the mindset of, like, I just remember that as like Leah Thompson.
Leah Thompson said that she wanted to direct it.
No.
She wants
really?
To do, like she
wow.
She wants to do another Howard the Duck.
They should.
Wow.
Because the first one was terrible, so they've got nothing to live up to there. And it was a genuinely really sharp and funny satirical comic book.
Okay, I would be into that.
Right?
I was too young to understand Howard the Duck. I will say that. Absolutely.
Oh, 100%. No, the movie's shit. You weren't too young to understand it. It was a terrible movie.
Okay, cancel that.
But the actual comic book is great.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. All right. Well, shout out to Stan Lee. R.I.P. We thank you for...
My friend Todd Alcott said on Facebook, R.I.P. Stan Lee, the highest grossing actor in the history of cinema.
Make them cameos up in heaven, dog. Alonzo, now, sir... Are you ready for your Christmas minute, son?
All right, you watching the clock?
Is it ready? Before I start the clock, can you briefly explain what this segment is?
Okay.
I don't know if people listened last week, but let them know what's going on.
All right, so we are being deluged already with Christmas movies on cable television, on Netflix, and all kinds of places. And so every week I have 60 seconds to talk about the new Christmas cable and streaming movies that I watched in the last week. And so every week I will have... plenty to talk. They are showing 12 movies over 9 nights on Thanksgiving week. So I might need a minute and a half for that. Or I'm going to have a heart attack. One of the two. But that's coming up later.
Okay. All right. Well, are we ready here? All right. Okay. Your time starts... ahora!
Okay, so Chandler Christmas Getaway on UpTV. I spent most of the movie being like, am I supposed to know these characters? I can't keep track of who's who, what's the deal? And then at the end where they start showing clips from the other films, I found out it's like the fifth one. So if you haven't already been watching these Chandler movies, you're going to have no idea what's going on. All right, now, moving over to Hallmark. It's Christmas Eve. It's Christmas, Eve, with Leanne Rimes. Kind of whatever. Actual snow is nice. The movie has no idea how school systems work or how to save art budgets, but there are some new songs by Leanne Rimes. They're lovely, so it's great. Then Christmas in Love, which is another movie that doesn't understand how bakeries work and is mostly ridiculous. It was really kind of negligible. So I don't have too much nice to say about it. Finally, A Veteran's Christmas on Hallmark Movies and Mysteries means well and has some interesting things to say about coming back from Afghanistan, but also treats its female lead character with lots of weird lack of agency rom-com stuff. I don't know what they were thinking on that one, but some cool dogs.
A minute, dog! Boom! Wow. Well, I'm proud of you.
You're a little frightened of me.
I always.
The last thing he said was cool dogs. Like, that was so necessary. Like, oh, I'm getting under the water. Cool dogs, though.
Credit where credit is due.
Well, thank you for that. We will be, that is a recurring segment every week until Christmas. We will have El Mero de Mero de Navinas Christmas Minute, y'all. And now, before we leave, it is time for our staff picks. Every week, we ask the panel to give us a staff pick, something they've watched, whether it's in the theater or streaming, what have you. April, I will start with you.
Alonzo, have you recommended Zama yet?
I have not. Have at it.
Shit. I'm late on
is
this.
Is that the zombie version of Alfonso Cuarón's Roma?
Zama. It's a movie out of Argentina by Lucrecia Martel. And she's wonderful. She has a movie called The Headless Woman that I love. She did a movie called La Cienega that is really wonderful.
Which actually kind of reminds me of Roma.
Yeah. But this movie is Zama. And she has such a dark sense of humor that is so subtle that sometimes you don't get it. But this is a story about colonial Argentina and about... these dumbass Spaniards who come over.
Hey.
Shout out to my DJ, Dumbass Spaniard.
Wildly underestimate how difficult it will be to, like, start this colony into, you know. So one guy, you know, named Zama, he starts losing his mind because he can't go home. And he's just like, oh, his kids are growing up. His wife is likely moving on. And he's just like slowly losing his mind. And then he's losing all the respect from other people, too. And one of my favorite things is just like all these like white skinned Spaniards who still are wearing their dumbass fucking white wigs, those giant
like powdered
wigs, and they're like so ravaged by heat and humidity that they look terrible, but they still feel the need to put them on, and they just look like they all look like lunatics, you know. And they're ordering around all of these like black slaves and then like the indigenous people to do things for them, but they just look crazy. And so it's such dark subversive humor, and I highly recommend Zama, and it is available, I think, on like all the streaming VOD stuff.
All right, Warren, that's what's up. Alonzo.
So Netflix has recently paid for the long-awaited reconstruction of Orson Welles' final film, The Other Side of the Wind, and it is a terrific film. He made it in the early 70s, and you watch this movie, and he's sort of like killing the 1960s and starting the 1970s. Like, this is a filmmaker who, three decades after Citizen Kane, still felt completely up to the minute and totally on top of what was happening in movies. And it feels like there's stuff in that movie that feels even innovative today, but it really feels like you can see where, you know, even though they never saw this movie because it never got finished, like, this is where, like, Altman and people like that were gonna pick up that baton and run with it. But there's several things to be watching for here, because there's the movie The Other Side of the Wind. There's a documentary from Morgan Neville, who did Won't You Be My Neighbor, called They'll Love Me When I'm Dead, which is about how the film got made and how it got derailed and why it never got finished. And then if you look in the Trailers and More section on Netflix on The Other Side of the Wind page, you'll find another documentary called A Final Cut for Orson, :40 Years in the Making, which is a documentary about the actual physical reconstruction of this movie and how they, like, got the footage, transferred it to digital, you know, looped the sound, did special effects to complete certain parts that hadn't been done, composed a score, all this different stuff. And it's just amazing piece of, like, detective work, and then just the nuts and bolts reconstruction of a movie like this, and how basically that given where digital technology is now, they probably couldn't have done it, you know, 10, 20 years ago, but they can do it now. And so it's this fascinating look into how it all came together. I recommend all three of these movies, Other Side of the Wind, They'll Love Me When I'm Dead, and A Final Cut for Orson. You can watch them in pretty much any order. I would say do They'll Love Me When I'm Dead first, then Other Side of the Wind, then Final Cut. But, you know, take your pick. It's all good. It's all fascinating.
Is that like a thing? I don't know. Like, you could look in Trailers and More and there might be extras there?
I don't know if it's always a thing, but that's where they stuck this one. So
interesting.
It's like, if you didn't know that, you wouldn't, you know, it would be just this little hidden Easter egg on Netflix. Yeah. But please go look for it, because it's a really, you know, I know, April, you're a fan of process. So, I, you know.
Big fan.
Yeah.
Craft process.
It is cool.
Love it.
It is cool to see all this stuff put together, and like how you have all these analog elements, you know, these you know, all these film reels, and the film was shot in a bunch of different stock, so it's on like 16 and 8 and whatever, and then you've got like your quarter inch audio and like all these different things coming together to make this movie. It's really riveting,
and they're all available on,
and they're all on Netflix.
They're all on Netflix right now, so holler at those, y'all. Thank you very much. I mean, I started off at the beginning of this show talking about 25 years ago, what a great time it was that Wu-Tang and Tribe Called Quest came out. Now, another great, dare I say, momentous date in history, April, looking at you, is this weekend. Did I finally go back and enjoy myself a McRib? You goddamn right I did. You goddamn right I did. I put my back into that bitch, yo. Delicious.
Is there a movie about McRibs that you're going to suggest?
No, there's not a movie about McRibs. But what movie did I watch whilst eating a McRib?
Did you have one or two?
I had one.
Because they want to sell you two now.
My man. I mean, I would fuck up two real quick.
Uh-huh. I mean, they're small.
Yeah.
They are small.
They're nibbles.
I mean, that's, yeah, it's almost like a, like,
they're a, like a White Castle slider, dude.
Damn. I was going to say a Chicken Little from KFC, but
it's an amuse-bouche. So, Ricardo, yes. What were you watching while you ate your McRib?
I was watching the 1999 Ted Demme joint, Life, which is currently streaming on Stars, and just a fucking fantastic movie. Holds up to this day, I say. And it is... did I enjoy it as a fucking Eddie Murphy fan growing up? Yes. Watch this movie. Watch it with my girl. Never seen life before. She was hyped. Never had a McRib before. She had never had McRib before. I was hyped. She loved the movie. Well, no, she was...
She gave it 1 out of 4 piglets.
1 out of 4 fake...
yoga
bone
mats.
Bone
fucking foam.
All that being said, Life.
Watch Life.
1999. Ted Demme. It's a really great, just fun... It's a fun movie. I mean, I don't know how else to say it. It's a fun movie, and the jokes are great. The performances are great, and when the credits roll, you have a big smile on your face.
How much gay bashing humor is there?
None.
Okay.
Well, you know,
Eddie Murphy in prison, and there's no gay bashing humor.
I will say there is a Miguel.
Think about it.
Miguel Nunez Jr., who plays Joanna Man, and Bernie Mac. They have an unspoken love affair in the movie, and it is not done disrespectfully.
Okay.
It is just. It's one of those like. It's 1990. It was the 90s, so they couldn't. They couldn't say flat out what was happening, but you know what is happening in the movie. But that storyline has a very, sad, great payoff to it. God, now I can't wait to hear fucking Alonzo's response to this movie. Yeah,
I will. I'll put it on the long list of things I need to be watching.
Asuka. And that's what's up, yo. Check out Life. Hey, y'all. Next week we are going to be talking about. Widows, directed by Steve McQueen. I am very excited about this movie. I don't know how you are feeling about that, but I am very much looking forward to watching that movie.
It's good.
Yeah?
Yeah.
That's what's up.
It's very good.
It's good.
I mean, we'll talk about it.
We'll talk
week.
About it.
You've said too much. Hey, y'all, if you like what you're hearing, leave us that good review on Apple Podcasts, y'all. 5-star reviews get a shout out on the show. This week we just have one, and it is from, I hope I am pronouncing your handle right, a C Van?
A7?
A7? A7, let's say that. And they say, if you like movies and like to laugh, listen. Or don't, but Alonzo won't send you a Christmas card. 6 stars!
Thank you. I'm not sending you a Christmas card either, but thank you for the review.
I don't get one, so you don't either.
It is a pleasure, as always, to see you,
Sir,
Alonzo.
This
a pleasure,
is a
as
delight.
Always, to see you, April. You know what's up.
Quick thing for anyone who's in Los Angeles. This is the time there's a ton of screenings that happen with a lot of Q&As, because everyone's just like, vote for this film. I'm going to be hosting 2 of them. So if you're in Los Angeles, there's a double feature with Winter's Bone and Leave No Trace.
Nice.
And I'll be doing the Q&A with... director Deborah Granick, and she's wonderful and is so wonderful to talk to that it will be a very, very good interview. And then the next morning, if you are in SAG or are SAG related, there is a screening of First Reformed followed by a Q&A with Paul Schrader and Ethan Hawke, and I'll be doing the Q&A with that, talking about, you know, Christianity and like existentialism and shit.
Yes.
So, yeah.
What's up? That is great.
Yeah, the Deborah Granick screening is open to the public, and if you go to AmericanCinematheque.com, you can get information about tickets.
Yep.
That's what's up, yo. A friend of mine has rented out the Lyric Hyperion Theater, which is here in Los Angeles. It's in the Silver Lake neighborhood. This Sunday, they are doing a screening of Nashville that will start at 3 p.m. There will be a Q&A and presentation before the movie. I will be participating in that. If you're in the Los Angeles area, please come out and enjoy that and enjoy Nashville. Members of Henry Gibson's family, I'm told, will be in attendance.
Oh, nice.
It's going to be a very lovely way to just enjoy your Sunday. So please come on to that. Please come out to that. It is free. There's no cover for that. Hey, if you got a comment or suggestion about this week's show, there are several ways that you can let us know. You can tweet us at WhoShotYaPod. You can send us an email at WhoShotYa@MaximumFun.org. Or you can call the Who Shot line and leave us a message. If, for example, you think there is too much Christmas talk.
Shut up.
How dare you? How dare you? And not enough Cloud Atlas talk? For real, though! For real, though! Go ahead and call us. The number is WSY-803-1664. That's 979-803-1664.
Speaking of Cloud Atlas, thanks to the person on our Facebook group who told us about the Jupiter Ascending Ballet.
Yeah! Shout out to that person, Mos Def. I saw that.
Can't wait.
Yes, I like that. Hey, our producer is Casey O'Brien, who is off getting married right now. Yes, so shout out to you getting married, you married motherfucker. Our senior producer is Laura Switcher. Laura Switcher, not getting married. Just living that single life, dog. I'm living my best life. Yes, what's up? This is a production of MaximumFun.org, and that is what is up.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.